My name is Kay. I am a grateful recovered alcoholic.
Amen.
And that's not really how I remember how it happened last Saturday night. As I was talking to Chuck, and he said, "Hey, when are you going to come up here and do your stick?" And I said, "When are you going to write me a check?" And I said, "Speaking's free. Comedy costs money." And he said, "Well, I need a speaker next Saturday night." So, but I am glad to be here. I'm glad to be sober, and I'm glad to be amongst some familiar faces, a lot of faces I've never seen before. For those of you that don't know me, the reference to comedy, I was, when I got sober in 1995, I came in the program. I was a stand-up comedian. Oh, keep your seats. I had been on the road for, at that time, for about four or five years, and I quit the road in 1997, and quit the clubs in 2001. But we'll get to more of that later. I'm supposed to tell you what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. What it used to be like was what all of us know. You know, step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And I have learned in this program that the second part of step one, that our lives had become unmanageable, that Bill was not speaking to all of the divorces and the jails and the craziness and the lampshades, you know, and the tables and all the crazy things that we do when we're drinking. It's my understanding he was referring to the unmanageability of being able to control the drinking. And when I got to this program, I would mumble that I was an alcoholic, but I really did not believe that I was, because I was not an everyday drinker. I didn't live under a bridge. I had not, you know, done the things that my dad had done. And so I really did not believe that I was truly an alcoholic. But I found my alcoholism in listening to other people's stories and reading the big book, you know, where Bill says that if you find that when you take alcohol, and I'm paraphrasing here, but if you find that when you drink that you have little control over how much you drink, you are probably an alcoholic. And I could really relate to that. I was born in 1961 in a rural Georgia. Back then it was a little town called Alpharetta, Georgia. I always say, yeah, it's real cool to say you're from there now. When I lived there, we had two traffic lights, three cops, and one town drunk who I called Daddy. And got started on that path real quick. And I remember when I was growing up, the police officers, we used to go to the, you know, part of my raising was at the American Legion Auxiliary. Woohoo! You know, I qualified. I was hanging out in the bar with my dad, you know, learning to shoot pool and doing the kind of things that you do in bars when I was growing up. Daddy was mostly an at-home drinker, but he did go to the American Legion. And I remember numerous times when I was growing up having a police officer who was also a member of the Legion saying to my mother, well, we, you know, did Jake make it home okay last night? We saw him weaving through town, and we just decided, you know, we, like, you know, take your chance, Jake, go on home. They would just follow him to the edge of town once he got out of the city limits. They, you know, they didn't have anything to do with him at that point. So some nights they would, some nights they would lock him up, some nights they would let him go. I remember all of the, you know, all of the insanity that goes along with that, being raised in an alcoholic home, my mother trying to get my daddy sober, us thinking that if we just did this and just did that and didn't do this and didn't do that, then he would get sober. And I know today that's just not true. My dad died literally from an overdose of alcohol. His death in 1976. I was 14 years old. His death certificate read, unintentional overdose of alcohol, alcohol poisoning. Now, knowing that at 14, a sane person would look at that and go, wow, alcohol can kill you. But an insane person who had already brought an alcoholic to her first drink, I was given alcohol at about 8 or 9 years old as cough medicine. My mother would give it to me in a tablespoon of whiskey in between doses of cough syrup. You know, the doctor said, well, you can only give her the codeine every 12 hours, but give her this whiskey. And I would actually fake coughing to get more of that. I'd spit and hack and gag and kick and scream and beg her not to give that stuff to me again, and then find myself just faking coughing so she would give it to me again. And I know now, you know, you guys taught me that's the phenomenon of craving that was setting in even way back then. You know, I brought an alcoholic to my first drink. I really believe that. Well, at 14, when Daddy died, there was a lot of shame in growing up in the 60s and 70s in an alcoholic home. Nobody else that we knew in our neighborhood, there was one other, quote, drunk that, you know, people talked about. We didn't really go to church that much. I remember thinking that church was a place of judgment. Church was a place that when your life is perfect, you can go there because all those people are perfect, and that's why we don't go there, because we're not perfect. And that was my jaded opinion. You know, my mother would talk about, you know, that she would like to go, but there was just so much shame going on with the alcoholism. And when Daddy died, you know, as hard as it is to admit today, but thanks to this program, I can admit it, that I was relieved. You know, I was relieved. This was 14 years of basic torture, you know, growing up in the alcoholic home and all the insanity that goes with that. And so then when you feel that relief, then there came all this shame. Well, 2 months later, I started drinking, thinking, because, you know, I have a thinker. Well, I just won't do it like Daddy did. You know, I won't turn out like my daddy. And with hand held high, I swore. He died February 2nd, 1976. I took my first drink sometime that spring. I know it was warm. And it was 1976. And I drank alcoholically the first night that I drank. I qualified. But I did it for 20 years. I did it over and over and over again. I drank that night until I passed out. There's numerous occasions that at 14, 15, 16 years old that I would drink myself into a blackout and just lose huge gaps of time. And I know all of you can relate to that. And I came in this program saying, well, I ain't never been in a blackout. And then I thought, well, I must have still been in a blackout, because I was still in a blackout the first 9 months of sobriety, because I had been in, you know, there were several gaps of time that I could not remember. And I went through high school drinking, you know, the post-high school years. I didn't go to college. I went to work in the business world, and I went to work with people. I always ended up hanging out with people, oh, how strange, that drank just like I did. And, you know, at 16 and 17 years old, I was allowed to go to Daytona, Florida, with this group of people that were already in college. They were college age, and going to Daytona and spending a week and just drinking the whole time. You know, that was normal activity for me. All the while, still swearing I would not turn out to be like my daddy. And that's the insanity of the alcoholism. I ended up going job after job after job. I mean, you know how the program goes. You work all these different jobs. You have all these different titles. You get all this different money, and you spend it on booze. I remember in 1984, I was working for a big company in Atlanta. It was a software company. And I had 7 sales reps that I was a secretary, little office manager and secretary for, these 7 sales reps. And for Christmas, every single one of them gave me a bottle of liquor. And they all said to me, that's all we know that you do. We knew you would like this. And I just, you know, thank you very much. You know, I was so grateful for them. And it was good liquor. I mean, it wasn't that Earl's vodka that I had been drinking. This was like Grand Marnier and Kahlua and all this fancy stuff that I couldn't afford to drink. And I continued drinking on through that job and other jobs. And up until 1986, I had never been fired from a job. And part of it was a result of my drinking, because I was coming in late, you know, I had a lot of upset stomachs, you know. I called in a lot with an upset stomach. And I was coming in late a lot and not being at work a lot, and they fired me. And it turned out they ended up having to reinstate me. But it finally got down to the point of, the guy called me in his office one day and was like, would you just leave? Would you just leave quietly and we'll make a deal with you? You know, and I just thought, well, that's a nice choice. I said, well, you were going to fire me if I don't quit? And he said, well, yeah, pretty much. We just don't have any reason right now to fire you. But they wanted me gone, you know. And of course, that was their fault, her fault. She's the one that turned me in. It's not my fault. It's just her fault. She's the one that's watching me every day. So in 1991, I decided, in all of my infinite wisdom, hey, I've been making people laugh my whole life at jobs. Why don't I try comedy, you know? And the lady that I was working with gave me an ad for a workshop in Atlanta. I was working for these two guys that one of them was having, he was having an affair with this woman that he'd been having an affair with for 20 years, and I found out he was cheating on her, and I was like, kind of guy I usually marry, you know? I mean, he was trying to cover up with his wife, his girlfriend, and trying to cover up his other girlfriend with his girlfriend, and I mean, boy, talk about unmanageability. And so I was constantly cracking jokes about that, and this lady that I worked with told me, well, you need, you know, you've missed your calling, you should go do comedy. I got angry enough at work one day that I called the number. It was a workshop that started in a couple of weeks. I think I had $150 in my checking account at that point, and the workshop was $135. Sounded like a logical investment to me. You know, go invest in something that's not going to give you any return on your investment for a long, long time. Yes, sign me up. And that's just also a part of the insanity that I realized when I was drinking. See, I always had beer money and I had other things money, but I just used to run out of rent money a lot. I didn't have any light bill money, but you know, I had just been to the liquor store and had money for that, but Mom, I just can't pay my light bill. Oh, you know, and Mom would come pay it. God bless her. But in 1991, I took that comedy workshop. I graduated in July of 91, and I was just off to the races. It was like, that's it. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do comedy. I started going crazy with that, just like we go crazy with everything else. I was working a job in Forest Park, Georgia, living in Woodstock, working 7-to-4 shift, and going from Forest Park to Huntsville, Augusta, Chattanooga, Birmingham, Alabama, all these different places where I could get stage time. And I would do that after I'd get off work at 4 o'clock, and I'd come back in, you know, at 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning, get up and go to work, do it all again the next day. And during that time, I was able to manage my drinking because I was on the road a lot during that time. But I had all the other things, you know. I had the other things going on while I was trying to manage the drinking. And in 1992, I always tell everybody I sold everything I owned, and took that $200, put it in the bank. Thank you, Mark. I was going to say, if Mark with issues gets my stuff and the rest of y'all don't, we got a problem. No, I didn't have a whole lot. That was the whole point of that. I think I traded my dryer for some other substance. I just, you know, the yard sale, you know, whatever. I did. I traded my dryer for something else. But anyway, I took that $200, started renting a room from people, and I started doing comedy. And this was the biggest mask that I had been able to wear yet, was being on stage. Because when I was on stage, I looked like what I wanted to be. I looked very self-confident. I looked like I just had it all together. I looked like nothing could shake me. And inside, it was this screaming, dying, hurt little girl that was still drinking and still doing other things to mask all of that pain. But this was my show. This was my facade. You know, I could be that just for those few minutes that I was up there. And I managed that for the next 4 years, well, 3 years, from 92 to 95. I got into a relationship. Oh, what a shock. A bad relationship. In 1994, which carried me into 95. And I knew when I got into this relationship that it was temporary, because they all were temporary. You know, and he just needed a good woman. I mean, that's what I saw, is that he just needed a good woman. It's like, well, what are you doing with me? But I thought I could fix him. You know, I used to say I should, like the Bob Vila of alcoholics, I should have my own show called This Old Drunk. You know, I'm going to marry you and fix you up. And it didn't quite work that way. Because he didn't like the fact that I ended that relationship so abruptly when I was just done with him. And he sort of started, you know, getting angry. Some people are starting to snicker because I came into this program September 10th, 1995, convinced I was being stalked by this man. So when I say admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, I had 20 years of proving my powerlessness over alcohol. I came in here September 10th, 1995. My last big drunk was January 13th, 1995. I knew as of the morning of January 14th, 1995, I couldn't do it anymore. That pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, the four hideous horsemen, what is it, frustration, terror, bewilderment, despair, all of that stuff was on me, and I just said, I can't do this anymore. But I did it again, and I got sober in church in Mother's Day 1995, so don't tell me getting sober in church don't work. I stayed sober 7 days, so I just wanted y'all to know that does work. They didn't give me no chip or nothing, but, you know, and I would do that from time to time. I always say I was raised Baptist alcoholic. I had a black belt Southern Baptist mother and a raging alcoholic father. And when I would go to church, I would go to the altar because that's what you do. Because the kind of churches that I went to, you're going to burst into flames sitting in that chair if you didn't get in that altar. You know, and I was going to hell in a handbasket by the time I was 14 years old. So I was in the altar every time I walked. I was just, every time I went to a church, I'd go to the altar. I come out, nothing would change. Oh, go figure. And but when I came here in 1995, I was convinced that this guy was stalking me. He was harassing me, and he was calling me a lot. And in my magic magnifying mind, okay, that was stalking. But to me, that's what it was. And, you know, it does talk about in the big book about the magic magnifying mind, and we blow things out of proportion. But I also look at it today that that is the very catalyst that drove me into this program. So I'm very grateful for that delusion that I was being stalked, even though that's not true. But we found that out 5 years into the program. It's like, oh, did I say stalker? I meant caller. Excuse me. Sorry. Little detail. But, so when I got here because I've got this, quote, stalker. I've got this best friend that was already here, and she had changed her thinking. And that got on my last nerve because that's all she would talk about. Well, I just had to change my thinking. I just had to change my thinking. And I was just like, you better change your thinking. I'm going to smack you. And I don't know about the rest of you, but you can't be an active drinker and an active thinker like we are and be around somebody like that because you're going to either get it or you're going to shoot them because they will get on your last nerve, you know. And this was a woman that had been my best friend, had been my best drinking buddy for all these years, and she had always told me what I needed to do to fix my problems. And now she's saying, well, pray about it. Well, I just have found God, and you just need to pray about it. And I'm just, I've been praying about stuff for years. I'd pray on my way to a bar, God, please don't let me get drunk tonight. God, please don't let me marry somebody I don't like again. Kept happening. I failed to mention the two failed marriages prior to this one that I'm in today. But I got here, I swore I was being stalked, and that's what I needed to think because that's what got me sober. Step two says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I had a power greater than myself. It was alcohol. It wasn't going to restore me to sanity. I had another power greater than myself. It was this God of my mother's understanding and this God of my granny's understanding. And he was out to get me, and he was condemning me. And I needed to get this third step of made a decision to turn our will in our life over to the care of God as we understood him. My very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous actually took place 30 days, or about 60 days before I picked up a white chip. I came so I could see my friend little happy Kathy, pick up her 30-day chip. And I remember seeing those words on the wall, God as you understand him. And I thought, oh, that's not right. That's wrong. You know, I had a bottle of vodka at my house and had other substances at my house, but that's wrong. You know, that's not right. And because that was that skewed thinking and that twisted thinking. So when I got here, I had to get a new understanding of God. And one of the things that I found for me, that I had to get busy working these steps ASAP. Because, and Jimmy E. used to say, the same alcoholic mind that created the problems to begin with has no capacity to solve the problem. If it did, it would have never created it to start with. So you have to change your mind and change your thinking. And that's where Kathy was coming here and listening to him. And she invited me. I got here by invitation. She's like, I invite you. Why don't you come and listen to this man talk? And I was like, okay. You know, Sunday morning, 11 o'clock, I come here. He didn't say a word. So I was angry because that just cut into some of my drinking time. And he sat here and didn't say a word. But I knew that when I got here 60 days later, when I came in because I was hurting so bad, the alcohol, I'd actually not had a drink in a few days when I came in here, but I had had a think, you know, I had been thinking a lot. And I knew that her life had changed here and I wanted my life to change here. And so I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous just wanting to change. Well, she told me, Kathy ended up being my first sponsor, and she told me, she said, if you want what I have, do what I did to get it. Well, of course, you know, I wanted to be happy. I wanted to be able to let go and let God. But, it's like, oh, we don't really want to do anything to get that. We're so used to the easier, softer way. And she said, if you want to do this, she said, I will work the steps with you. So we got busy, and we started working the steps. And that's just the school of AA that I was brought up in, is that, you know, I hear people all the time say that, well, there's no time frame to work in the steps. And I had somebody tell me a couple of years ago, yes, there is. We read it every day and how it works. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. And that's what she told, you know, that if you want this thing, then you got to do this thing. So we started doing it. I did my fifth step. I did my fourth step. I was just searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. Well, that won't take long. I don't have many morals. So I had three morals, that is. And I didn't, you know, have a clue. You know, and that's why the steps are in order for a reason, because God started revealing to me the clues that I needed. And I remember when I did my fifth step with Kathy, January 1st, 1996. And I was looking at my two previous marriages and looking at their inventory, at what they had done to me. And I said, gosh, how sick they were. And she said, oh, I know. She said, they had to be to marry you. So as soon as she scabbed over, we finished the and we moved on, and I realized that the things that, you know, it says in the fifth step that we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. It doesn't say the exact nature of how sorry we are. It says the exact nature of our wrongs. I had done a lot of people wrong. A lot of them were dead. A lot of them I had wished that they were dead. And a lot of them I just said, I ain't going there. And I was told to make a list, you know, go on through the steps and get to step 8 and make a list of the persons that we had harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. And the key word there was just to become willing. Didn't mean I had to do it all right then, but as time has progressed, I get more and more willing each year to make those amends. And I've still got amends that I need to make. some of them, you know, I've put it totally in God's hands because I don't know where some of these people are. At about 4 years sober, the only male figure in my life that had really never abused me, I don't really talk about this much at AA meetings, but for some reason I'm just going to say this. I was abused when I was a kid, not by my dad, not by any real blood relatives, but it was a lot of abuse in my childhood, a lot of perpetrators, I'll leave it at that. And I drank over that stuff for a number of years. If this had happened to you, then you would drink too. If this had happened to you, then you would behave this way too. And the truth is, I drank that way because I was an alcoholic. The rest of it, I thought, you know, had something to do with it. It really didn't. It was my reasoning for acting the way that I did. But at about 4 years sober, the only man in my life of an authority figure was my stepfather. My mother had married him when I was 18 years old. He was a very good Christian man, and he died of pancreatic cancer. And thanks to this program, I was able to be there and help be a nurse to him and minister to him while he was dying. And that is just truly, I mean, that is just the most awesome blessing, to take care of someone that you love that is dying. And if I had been drinking, oh, it would have just been all about me, and oh, I can't handle this, and oh, I can't watch this, I can't be there. Oh, you don't, oh, I can't be there, no way. And I couldn't not be there, you know. I prayed and I asked God to give me that intuitive thought to be there, because we didn't live with them. We just lived a few miles away at that time. And he gave me that blessing to be there the night that my stepdad took his last breath. And that was one of the gifts. And, you know, anybody that's ever lost a loved one in this program, you know what I'm talking about, is it was a gift to be able to be there to give back to this man. But see, that's the kind of stuff that I would have normally would have used that as a reason to drink. And the next year I spent wallowing in the sympathy and a lot of self-pity, you know, that here I had lost two dads, you know, and I lost one to alcoholism, and I lost one to cancer, and oh, woe is me, and oh, poor pitiful me. And I met this lady at Cartersville, and she became my new sponsor because Happy Kathy had fired me. And we kind of fired each other. I mean, she'd been my best friend forever. She'd been a wonderful sponsor. It just got to the point where I didn't want to listen, because see, you come into the program, you start working the steps, and you start doing the things that it suggests, and it smashes that ego. You know, you have that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization when you get here, and then you start getting a little dose of humility. Well, then I just started getting a little bit of the ego. I call it the Easter of my ego. It resurrected itself, and I mean, I got to the point, honestly. I got to the point where people would come up to me after me and they go, oh, I just love what you share. And I thought, thank you, so do I. And don't tell me y'all hadn't done that. But because that is that alcoholic ego, you know. And I got thinking, oh, I did something, you know, I did something right. And I just got dang right crazy. I was stone cold sober and full-blown bat poop crazy. And so Kathy had moved on. We were still friends, and she was still my baby's goddaughter, but we had moved on. And I met this woman at Cartersville, and she became my sponsor. And all she heard me say in meetings was, well, I was stalked into the program. You know, I would just share that in every meeting. Well, I don't know about y'all, but I was stalked in. And I say, I got invited by one and stalked by another. And the thing that really got me is, if I had any sense, you know, when Kathy invited me to come to a meeting, she didn't invite nobody else. So I think she invited the person she thought needed it the most. But in about 4 years sober, I met this woman, and she told me I was still holding on to garbage from my past. I was still holding on to the resentment against these people who had perpetrated me, because in that I held no role. I held no accountability. Those people did that stuff to me when I was a little girl. I had no power and control over that. And she said, you're absolutely right. And she said, and I want you to write down every single name of those people that you can think of. And I want you to write it on a separate piece of paper. And when you write it, I want you to write at the top of that paper, this is not happening to me today. And I'd have to write down. I did my fourth step again. Well, she lied and told me it was my tenth step because she knew I could. She couldn't get me to do another fourth step. I did it right the first time, girl. I ain't doing it again. And because I got that ego. And she told me, well, then just do a tenth step. So I wrote all this stuff down, and she gets me to her house, and we laugh about it now about how she just kind of locked the door and like, you ain't getting out till you get some of this garbage out of you. And she wanted to know, how do you qualify to be an Alcoholics Anonymous? I was like, I'm 4 years sober, woman. What do you mean, how do I qualify? She said, I want to know if you qualify for a seat in this room. All I ever hear you talk about is being stalked in here. That don't qualify you. Oh my gosh, this was a trick. And I started, she said, I want to know about some times that you drank and got drunk when you swore you weren't going to have a drink. And I want to know about some times when you drank and got drunk when you swore you weren't going to get drunk. So I thought of a few things. She said, now what is this about this stalker? And I said, well, he was just, he was calling me a lot, and he was house. She said, did he come to your house? And I was like, well, no, he didn't come to my house, but he said he was going to. He said he was going to. And she said, can we just reframe that and think that this man was perhaps just an ex-boyfriend that was obsessive and possessive and just didn't want to let go? Was he really stalking you? And over the course of time, and some of you have heard me share this, and it's embarrassing, but it's the God's honest truth. I lived in Marietta, Georgia. He lived in Edgefield, South Carolina, which was about, 200 miles away. He worked at a comedy club in Augusta, where I used to work, making $180 a week as kitchen boy. And there's nothing wrong with working in the kitchen. There's absolutely nothing wrong with working in the kitchen. But when you spend all your money that you make working in the kitchen on dope and don't spend it for any light bill money or any rent money, and he was constantly going to get evicted and constantly, but see, he just needed that good woman, so I'm going to help him. Well, not only did he live in South Carolina, he only made $180 a week working at this comedy club, so it wasn't like he was going to jet set in here and get me. And the real kicker was he did not know where I lived. But he was stalking me. And to me, like I said, I needed to think that. I was 4 years sober when I realized that. And I remember being at a Saturday morning meeting and sharing that one day. And a lady that was here when I got sober raised her hand when they asked for burning desires. She said, I would just like to express my extreme disappointment in Kay Stalker. Because she said, all these years I thought there was some 6'10" guy outside her bedroom with a knife in his hand. Comes out, trying to find out he was just calling her. He didn't even know where she lived. But I had to get rid of all of that stuff. I had to get rid. What my new sponsor helped me to realize, and thank God for her, and thank God she didn't see me when I first came in, because all she had ever heard me say was, I was stalked into the program, I was stalked into this. She wanted to know, if I qualified to be here. And what I realized is that I was in my ego when I was saying I was stalked in, because, all you people got here because of alcohol. Well, I had me a stalker, Well, today, I know I was stalked in this program by a substance called John Barleycorn. That's what the big book calls it. It was a substance that was out to kill me. And in order to get rid of that substance, as the big book says, I had to find a power greater than myself that wasn't out to get me. And I found that same God of my understanding, that same God that Mama and Granny taught me about growing up, that same God that they talked about in the Baptist church, and when they told me I was going to burst into flames if I didn't get that altar, I found as a loving father, a loving God in this program. And that is thanks to the steps and thanks to you people. Moving on in the steps, like I said, I started making my amends and trying to right some wrongs. And I remember Kathy telling me specifically and my new sponsor telling me specifically that, the big book says a remorseful mumbling of I'm sorry won't fill the bill at all. They know you're sorry. You know, you lived a sorry life. I lived a sorry life. I'm not saying you. I'm saying I lived a sorry life. They knew I was sorry. I needed to let them know, let people know how I had wronged them. And I remember the night that I sat at my mother's kitchen table with my stepfather. This was before he died. And I told them some of the things. I didn't go into grave detail because that would injure them. I just told them I had not been the best daughter. I had not been the best steward of my money or their money. And that I knew that I had done them wrong, and I would try everything in my power with God's help to make that right. And I'll never forget my mother going, "Oh, well, honey, we knew you was drinking a lot. We smelled it on your breath. Pass the spaghetti." I wanted a drum roll. I wanted some kind of Academy Award, you know. Just wanted to just, it's okay. It's okay today because I'm not doing that stuff anymore. It's not okay. It was not okay when I was doing it. And, you know, step 10 says that we continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. I'm not so big on the promptly thing, but I do try to, you know, take that inventory and find out if I've hurt somebody or if somebody tells me I've hurt them, is to realize that I don't need to just tell them I'm sorry. I need to say, I did you wrong, and what can I do to fix it? You know, because I had been sorry all my life. I had said, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, 1,000 times. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. One of the things that hit me about that step, that's the only step that says we tried. All the other steps says that we admitted, we came, we made, we admitted, we were ready, we humbly asked, we made, we continued, we sought. And step 12 says we tried to carry the message to other alcoholics. And it hit me, the reason I think that it says we tried is because that's the one thing I don't have control over, is whether somebody gets this message or not. Nobody beat me over the head with this message. I came in, and even though I was stopped, I wanted to change my life. I found my alcoholism by just listening in these rooms. I actually really connected the first time I heard a speaker, first time I was at a speaker meeting. It was on a Saturday night, and I thought, well, I couldn't possibly have anything in common with this man. He was from another country, spoke broken English at best. And he stood up, and he was 50-something years old, and he stood up here and told my story. He told me how alcohol made him feel. And so I found my alcohol. I came to, and then I came to believe that I was an alcoholic. But where it says we tried to carry this message to alcoholics, I missed that somehow, and I was getting my cape on, and da-da-da, here she comes to save the day. And when I would sponsor people, I would just completely lose myself in that person. You know, you've heard it said, we carry the message, we can't carry the drunk. Well, I was trying to carry the alcoholic. And getting in God's way, I mean, not letting some things happen that probably should have happened, trying to be people's lawyer, trying to be their mother, trying to be their guardian, trying to be their, you know, and I mean, I just flat wore myself out. I remember when Eddie's brother, most of y'all know that I'm married, I'm Mrs. Eddie Lee, when he talks about his beautiful wife and the goat, I'm the wife. just so y'all know. We got rid of the goat. Thank God he didn't get those confused. But we got rid of the goat a couple of weeks ago. Eddie's brother came up here to live in 1999, 2000, something like that. And I tried to carry the message to him. I put my life in danger to try to carry the message to him. And this is where one of the bottoms that I hit sober was trying to change another person. And all the while, it was still me that needed to change and needed to change my thinking because I was still playing God. I had missed that part about this is the how and the why of it. First, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. It still doesn't work. And here I was, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years sober and trying to get this. I would get in his face and scream at him and tell him, if you don't stop doing this to yourself, you're going to die. And I will never forget a young lady sitting right here in the second row. Abby told me one night, she said, every time you say that to him, he thinks, thank God, when? Because when you're in the throes of this disease, dying is a welcome option at the time. That would be a welcomed choice at the time. Because it's a slow, alcoholism is not a quick death usually. It's typically a slow, torturous death, but it is a certain death. You know, I watched my daddy pursue it into the, you know, they say we pursue it into the gates of insanity or death, and he pursued it into the gates of death. Well, when Eddie's brother was up here, there was an 8 o'clock speakers meeting. We lived over here in Ackworth then. I was going to meetings in Cartersville some. It was 8 o'clock speakers meeting here. There was an 8 o'clock discussion meeting in Cartersville, and Eddie's brother had called several times that night, crying, begging Eddie to come see him. And Eddie said, I'm not going over there. He didn't have a phone. He just had to go to the payphone and call, and he'd leave a message. And he said, I'm not going over there tonight. He's already drunk. He's probably already passed out at this point. I'm not going. Well, I'm going to a meeting. I'll go. I'll go check on him. And I went over there that night, and I put myself in harm's way, because there were, and the whole time that Eddie is talking to me as I'm walking out the door, he's talking about the plumber. My husband's a carpenter, and he had just contracted a plumber to run a gas line for him, and the guy said he needed a $300 deposit. So the whole time he's talking to me, he's talking about the plumber. And he's talking about me coming to the meeting. He didn't hear that I was going to Cartersville. He thought I was coming up here and the plumber was coming up here. So he gives me the $300 and says, give this to him when you see him. And he's talking about the plumber, but I've got the alcoholic that I need to save on my brain. So I go over to Red Barn Trailer Court over here and I hand my brother-in-law the $300. And he looked at me and he said, what's that for? And I, you know, imagine that. You're home drunk on a Saturday night and some girl shows up and gives you $300. You know, he said, what's that for? I said, well, some people use it for rent and light bills, but I know what you'll use it for. Eddie said to give this to you. No, he didn't. He said to give it to the plumber. But I've got Buster on the brain because I'm trying to save him. I get on the phone and call my husband. He said, what do you mean you gave it to him? That's for the plumber. I go back over there. He's already got 2 duck dealers sitting in his living room. And I march in. I got a 2-year-old at home. And I march through that door. Give me that money back. What money? I ain't got no money. What money are you talking about? I didn't have any sense. I was sitting there arguing with him. And he finally, the guys leave, because I think I scared them. You're crazy, bitch. But I really do. I think I ran them off. But he finally gave me the money back after he tortured me. Well, now I'm done with him. Now I hate him. Now I don't care if he dies. You know, how sick is that? I go over there and put my life in harm's way to save him. Now I'm ready to kill him myself. So that was the bottom that I needed to hit to get me into our sister program, because I was born into an, I was an Al-Anon long before I was an alcoholic, and I needed something to solve those problems of insanity as well. And thank God that when my brother-in-law did die from this disease, he died in October 2002, he just got drunk one night and was partying with his friends, and he fell down a flight of basement stairs, and that's not supposed to kill you. But when you're partying with your friends, and they know you're just a drunk, and they just, he'll sleep it off. Well, he's still sleeping it off. He died 36 hours later. And thank God that I had learned to love him right where he was, with the disease, intact, aggressively working in his life, But I was able to stop judging him for it. Here I was judging him for the same thing that was wrong with me. But see, I get on this spiritual and moral hilltop and look down and say, you need to come up here. And I finally crawled down and said, I love you right where you are. And that is just by the grace of God and the fellowship of these programs that I was able to do that. And when Chuck asked me if, or when I did say that I would come and speak, you know, I know some of you were thinking, it's going to be so funny, it's going to be so entertaining. Well, nobody wrote me a check, so. No, it is truly by the grace of God that I could stand up here tonight, 9.5 years sober, 9.5 years ago, on September 9th, if you had told me that if I would just put down the drink and just put down the other stuff, if I would surrender my life to a God that I didn't even know at that time, that I could marry a good man and that I could have a home and that I would be able to quit the mask and quit the facade that I was putting on to get up on that stage, to stay at home, to do what was best for our child, that I would be an active member of the PTA when she was in public school and now be a stay-at-home homeschool mom, I would have thrown back another shot and said, yeah, right. But it happened. Don't quit before the miracle happens. Thanks for letting me share.